that offers girls the opportunity to discover a certain ferocity within themselves, something which there is little provision for outside of the stamping ground of the Amazons. Here a girl can be not only a girl, but also a boy, not just loving, but also hating, not only defensive, but also aggressive, not just tender, but also violent, not only gentle, but also demanding, not only modest, but also dominant. It offers a female rider a place and an object of gender transgression. Girls and horses, both swift and shy, difficult to tame, always ready to flee. Young girls, write Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari, quoting Marcel Proust, are fugitive beings. By their nature, they are pure relations of speed and slowness and nothing else. A girl is late on account of her speed. She did too many things, crossed too many spaces in relation to the relative time of the person waiting for her. Thus, her apparent slowness is transformed into the breakneck speed of our waiting. Herodotus tells the story of how the Scythians broke in the Amazons. After the victorious battle of Thermodon, the Hellenes sailed homeward with the captured Amazons divided between three ships. On the way, the Amazons rose up and slaughtered all the men and sailed on alone. Unfamiliar with the art of sailing, they drifted about until they finally landed on Lake Maeotis at Cremne, which stands in the land of free Scythians. They stole a herd of horses and went rampaging through Scythia, again on horseback. When the Scythians realized, astonished, that it was not a band of young men attacking them, but women, they rallied their youngest men, about as many as they assumed there were Amazons. They were instructed to live in the vicinity of these women, to flee if they were attacked by them, and when the women desisted, to return and live alongside them. When the Amazons accepted that the men meant them no harm, they left them alone. The young men began to imitate the Amazons, hunting and pillaging like them, and day by day the two camps came closer together. Around noon, the Amazons would go off alone or in pairs to relieve themselves, and the young Scythians did the same. Until eventually, one of them waylaid an Amazon on her own. She did not resist him, but communicated to him by signs that he should come back the next day and bring a companion, and that she would also bring a friend. The four met each other, liked each other, and the rest is history. Then the remainder of the young men, when they learned what had happened, writes Herodotus, came and broke in the remainder of the Amazons. That was not the end of the story, of course, because now it was important for the women to secure some financial security from the young men and set up something of a mobile household with their new partners. The Amazons feared the vengeance of the Scythians, from whom they had stolen their sons, and could not conceive of living together with their Scythian in-laws. We have no customs in common with them. We have never learned to do women's work. We shoot arrows, throw javelins, ride horses. But what do your women do? None of the things we just listed. They only ever do women's work. So you can see, it would be quite impossible for us to get along. Again the young men acquiesce, and the partially broken-in horsewomen and their men move together to a new territory, where they live a wild life as mounted hunters and predators. To this day, the image of the Amazons is marked by Greek myth-making, the curious mixture of shock and awe, horror and fascination, that these wild riding women inspired in each of the legendary heroes who had to grapple with them, Hercules, Theseus, Achilles, as captured in verse and painted on vases. It is to the fertile imagination of the Greeks that we owe the sensational attributes of the Amazons, such as their supposed lack of breasts, or having only one, it being suggested that the warrior women improved their ability to shoot a bow by burning off their right breast. Since Greek culture had no prototype for the femme fatale, the source of this danger was located far away from the homeland of the Greeks, off in remote Scythia, to the northeast of the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. Were the Amazons just a Greek male fantasy? That's what has long been surmised. Recent archaeological findings suggest otherwise, though, as historian Adrian Mayer notes. Recent and ongoing discoveries do offer astonishing evidence of the existence of authentic women warriors whose lives match the descriptions of Amazons in Greek myths, art, and classical histories, geographies, ethnographies, and other writings. Scythian graves do contain battle-scarred skeletons of women buried with their weapons, horses, and other possessions. Scientific bone analysis proves that women rode, hunted, and engaged in combat in the very regions where Greco-Roman mythographers and historians once located Amazons. Incidentally, the Greeks were not the only ones who dreamed and spun yarns about the legendary Amazons. In all literary cultures of the Middle and Far East, Egypt, Persia, India, China, we come across the notion of the female horseback warrior, whose actual sphere of life would most likely have been located among the nomadic steppe peoples of Eurasia. Among such equestrian populations, it was customary for a girl to ride and learn to shoot with the bow, just as boys did, and to take part in hunts, battles, and looting. Frequently, they were the ones who chose their male partners, or only allowed themselves to be conquered after a ritual duel. As Meyer puts it, Amazons were enthusiastic lovers of men of their own choosing. They tended towards casual sex, but, as Herodotus suggests, they also entered into strong monogamous bonds. The coexistence of the warrior girls and women with their horses is thought to have been particularly close. The girls learned from the horses and vice versa. Indeed, this was common not only with Amazons. Early on, practically since the beginning of their alliance, nomadic tribes had closely studied their horses' behavior. They knew, for example, of the authority mares enjoyed within a herd. Mares can be as strong and fast as stallions, and they can fight ferociously. An alpha female horse dominates the other members of the herd and physically disciplines the young male horses, while the stallions help defend the herd and await the mare's sexual interest. Admittedly, the ancient female riders were not the first to realize that there was something to learn from horses. Among the tribes of nomads and their horses, there have always been learning processes, going both ways, touching on all common areas of life. Migratory movement, rest periods, sexual behavior, methods of fighting and avoiding danger, models of alertness and understanding body language. In these learning processes, the important thing was to develop common rhythms and a fast, sensitive mutual understanding. Certainly no one would think of trading our traditional psychology, which clings to its cuddly toys and life-phase models, wholesale for the reading of Herodotus, or the results of archaeology and cultural cognition research. No one would think in such an anachronistic way. But perhaps we do still need to accept, in all modesty, that when it comes to young girls and horses, and the deeper reasons underlying their close affinity, we have not yet heard the last word. Riding and drawing. More than half a millennium has passed since Hans Baldungrian compared a shapely horse with a beautiful woman. But his comparison is by no means confined to the past. And neither do the semantics of riding and being ridden belong to the Department of Ancient Literature and Art. In 2013, a commercial for the Honda CBR 1000RR superbike was taken off air following criticism that it was sexist. It showed the transformation of a beautiful woman, the Spanish model Ángela Lobato, into a shapely motorbike, with the suggestion that a male driver would get a thrill leaning into the curves. This metamorphosis, which Ovid might well have admired, was accompanied by the beginning of the song Smack My Bitch Up by The Prodigy. Besides this one line from the song, the ad had no text. To add any more in English, where the verb to ride retains a perfectly vivid memory of the original motorbike ride, would have led to inevitable redundancy. In any case, without the need for words, the advert showed that the light metronomic shift from the act of riding to the sexual act and back is familiar to many cultures where the bridge to the age of horses was thought to be long gone. We're on slippery ground here. It can be difficult to assert innocence in this context. Whoever paints, draws, or films people in the position of the horse, whoever treats a man or woman like a mount, has poor grounds to claim ignorance. Playing horses is not the same as playing doctors. When someone is being ridden, clearly comparisons are drawn. The potential is there, at least, for equality to be thrown out of the window, with no hope of reversing roles. Humiliation, writes American essayist Wayne Kostenbaum, is an observable lowering of status and position, whereby the visibility is of as much importance as the reduction in status and position. It's a trite observation, perhaps, but humiliation creates a triangular relationship. The victim, the abuser, that is, the perpetrator, and a witness. One need not necessarily mount another individual to humiliate them. Dwarfed animals are just as badly off after all. The Roman emperors, for example, were, as Montaigne describes, extremely given to experimentation when it came to having their carriages pulled. Mark Antony was the first to be drawn through Rome, with a minstrel girl beside him, by lions harnessed to a coach. Heliogabalus did the same somewhat later, claiming to be Cybele, the mother of the gods. Then, drawn by tigers, he pretended to be the god Bacchus. On other occasions, he harnessed two stags to his coach. Once it was four dogs. Then, he stripped naked and was drawn in solemn procession by four naked girls. A common motif, frequently reworked by artists of the Renaissance and the Baroque, is that of an old man being ridden by a young woman. More depictions show the woman sitting side saddle, holding the whip in her right hand and the reins in her left hand, with which she steers the old man. Hans Baldwin Gren also produced a woodcut of this motif in 1513, and, as with most erotic themes, his work is more vivid than that of his contemporaries. In Baldung's woodcut, both participants are naked, and the rider holds up the little finger of her right hand, which holds the whip, as if to suggest the exquisite pleasure she is deriving from her erotic abuse of power. The old man, her mount, is not just anyone. The story that Baldung is illustrating is that of Aristotle being enslaved by Phyllis, a well-known fable at the time, thanks to a popular medieval verse narrative. The story goes that the venerable old philosopher, the teacher of Alexander the Great, falls in love with his pupil's consort, Phyllis. Aristotle teaches his disciple to show restraint and resist her, and then Phyllis seeks her revenge. With the lure of erotic favors, she compels Aristotle to let her ride on his back, with Alexander as witness, watching his tutor in this degrading position. The artist lets us observe this scene of humiliation through his eyes, putting us, the viewer, in the position of Alexander. The young woman who turned the head of a lascivious old man and led him to this humbling act was, and remains, stock satire material. In German theatre, we think of Kleist's comedy, The Broken Jug. What's significant about the legend of Phyllis and Aristotle is that the old man is an important philosopher. Indeed, the Stagerite was for a long time known only as the philosopher. This sharp drop in status is all the more degrading, since he is treated not as a bear or a mighty stallion, like something from modern advertising, but as a simple, plodding hack. The contemplative, philosophical thinker was now paraded about on all fours, à quatre pattes, as Rousseau was accused of calling on others to do. The consequence of Aristotle's uncontrolled lust was that he was pushed down to the basic level of animals. He found himself, literally, debased. From the point of view of technological history, we can see from the prints and drawings of Baldung and his contemporaries that in the 16th century there was not yet any differentiation between whip and riding crop. Phyllis and her cruel cousins handled their old nags, as was typical at that time, with a small whip with a short handle and a short cord. It's not unlike the toy whip with which Friedrich Nietzsche furnished his adored friend Lou Salomé for a famous photograph taken in Lucerne by Swiss photographer Jules Bonnet, in which she rides a wagon pulled by Nietzsche and Paul Ray. 50 years later, in May 1882, Salomé described in her memoirs the scene in Bonnet's studio that day. Nietzsche, she writes, arranged a photograph of the three of us, in spite of strong objections on the part of Paul Ray, who suffered throughout his life from a pathological aversion to the reproduction of his features. Nietzsche, who was in a playful mood, not only insisted on the photo, but took a personal hand in the details. For example, the little, far too little, cart, and even the touch of kitsch with the sprig of lilacs on the whip, etc. Ray's alleged reluctance is not discernible in the photograph. On the contrary, none of the three looks into the camera more comfortably. He is the very picture of bonhomie. At the geometric center of the image, the thumb of his right hand is tucked into his waistcoat, while his other fingers rest on his stomach, halfway between the top button of his open frock coat and the top of his trousers. No bold Napoleonic gesture, but the perfect expression of a contented bourgeois. The second horse in the team could not look more different. Nietzsche, the older man here, a mature 38, takes his part in the studio masquerade before the background image of the snow Jugendfrau Martin, the maiden, looking astonishingly serious. With his prophetic expression, the pastor's son seems to focus on something vague in the distance, as if he had already seen Zarathustra striding down to the valley. Finally, the young beauty riding in the cart, crouching like a cat, she tilts slightly forwards and to the right, holding the reins in her left hand, like Phyllis, as she steers the philosophers, with a knotted child's whip in her right. The young Russian lends the image what Roland Barthes would have called punctum. She is the only one who truly stares at the camera, and therefore at the viewer, with a strong, clear look, as severe as her breathlessly tight-laced wasp waist. The fourth figure is the only one not to be seen in the picture, although in fact he's the main character. The horse does not make a personal appearance, represented only by his job description. The absent figure is located both in the cart that its deputies are pulling and in the whip that they are supposed to fear. The horse's strongest representation, in absentia, though, are the two understudies, the men, who are harnessed in his place. The main thrust of the critique of womankind that Nietzsche formulated in Thus Spoke Zarathustra, only a few months after the practical joke photoshoot at Lucerne, considers the fundamental difference in positions of power. The happiness of a man is, I want. Of a woman it is, he wants. In his notes, Nietzsche goes a step further and suggests Oriental origins to this erotic despotism. By virtue of love, man searches for the absolute slave, the woman, the absolute slavery. Love is the desire for a past culture and society. It harks back to the Orient. His infamous line about not forgetting your whip if you're visiting women stands out in this regard. In his posthumously published fragments, the sentence is unabashed, while in Zarathustra, it is veiled in a literary device, uttered within quotation marks. It is not Zarathustra that says this, prompted by the author, but rather it's a little piece of advice offered to him by an old woman. A literary trick intended to hide the author from the line of fire and lend the text a level of mystique. As a strategy against interpretation, it might have been helpful. But what Jacques Derrida called the climate of a text cannot be saved with a dodge like this. The first book of Zarathustra shows how Nietzsche started to gain authority as a writer the further he roamed from the marshy territory of gender psychology. He did not succeed in turning this boggy ground into something fruitful. He did not become an Ibsen, a Schnitzler, Wedekind, Weiniger, or a Freud ahead of his time. He merely glimpsed the land of gender understanding from a distance. He did not set foot and explore. In formal terms, the Lucerne Group photograph parodies a childhood scene, such as that painted by Philip Otto Rung in The Hülsenbeck Children, 1805. The iconographer might, of course, be unimpressed by the comparison, because Rung's little girl in the cart makes no attempt to steer, and is not the one wielding the whip. That's in the hand of the younger of her brothers. Chronologically closer to the Lucerne staging is The Courtesan, 1873, by French Salon painter Thomas Couture, plate 26. Here we see two young artists, a poet and a painter, flanked by a knight and the god of drunken revelry, Silenus, before the carriage of a scantily clad allegory of beauty lashing her whip at them, while behind her sits a crooked old lady, a reminder of the transience of youth and beauty. Unlike the wagon in the Lucerne studio, the vehicle is here no mere toy, but a full-size carriage, the typical Parisian cab of the era. With this canvas, Couture is calling on a tradition entrusted to him as an academic teacher, the iconography of Apollo in his sun chariot. It is quite conceivable that the classical philologist Nietzsche had the idea of the unequal brother gods Dionysus and Apollo in mind when he choreographed the scene in Bonnet's studio. However, we can't help wondering about the atypical draft animals. In classical mythology, we would rather expect to see animals, usually horses. In both the Lucerne photograph and in Couture's painting, we have men in the harness and women wielding the whip. Man is no longer asked to give a ride, as with Aristotle and Phyllis. Now he's called upon to replace the horse as a draft animal too. Considering references in cultural history at this point, we recall the dark romanticism of the era, the cult of the femme fatale, and the literary tradition of masochism. The late 19th century, shortly before the fin de siècle, sees an explosion in the realm of sexuality, with ever greater differentiation, especially at the margins where domination, violence, and inequality of roles all loom. Seen in this context, the two philosophers harnessed to the wagon of a young Russian lady in Lucerne in 1882 are nothing but the protagonists of a grand récit, which we might, were it not for the risk of confusion with the Nazi ideologue Alfred Rosenberg's eponymous book, call the myth of the 20th century. These male draft animals may have been a product of the nervous age, but human draft horses of both sexes are a much older trope. The Romans were no stranger to the infamous yoke that those they defeated were made to pass beneath, missio sub iugum. Indeed, twice they had to undergo this humiliation themselves. A painting by the Flemish artist Paolo Fiammingo, Castigo di Amore, 1585, from his four-part Amori series, shows what it means to be under the yoke of God's love. A couple is hooked up with a suggestion of a harness to a carriage driven by an ungracious charioteer. Plate 25. Their cruel slave driver is a diminutive Eros, threatening his draft animals not with a whip, but with the flaming sword of expulsion from paradise. Indeed, the draft animals here are a human couple being chastised by the god of love and expelled from the Garden of Eden. Cursed, therefore, are not the men who are made to act as horses, and not the women who ride them. Cursed are both sexes, because of their differentiation by gender. Cursed be the sex that drives them from paradise, and chains them eternally to the carriage of the vengeful Eros. Perhaps this was the message Nietzsche intended to convey in that curious, uptight studio shot in Lucerne. Never mind the whip, with or without it, love is as good as hopeless. It's irrelevant who's sitting up top and who's pulling the cart down below. Either way, love always results in humiliation for both parties. That's why love always longs to return to the Orient. Because while it seeks exaltation, it brings only debasement. In the metropolis of the late 19th century, teeming with cabs parked in the shadow of cavalry monuments, horses and carriages act as a simple index of social inequality. One sits up above, the other pulls and sweats down below. Sex is one of the generators of social inequality, placing one up above, the other down below. And yet, it is also a great perverter of hierarchy. It debases those who were previously exalted. When we speak of sex, we are also speaking of humiliation, and neither sex is invulnerable. Nietzsche's topicality lies in this message. It resonated with the playwrights and sexologists who followed him over the next couple of decades, and it is the link to the experiences and the visual memory of the people of the 20th and 21st centuries. The severest whip scene in 20th century cinema, incidentally, was in a film by John Huston. In his 1967 Reflections in a Golden Eye, an adaptation of a novel of the same name by Carson McCullers, Marlon Brando, playing a U.S. Army major with homophilic inclinations, injures his wife Leonora's horse when riding it, for which she, played by Elizabeth Taylor, lashes him several times across the face with the riding crop, in the presence of their guests. The melodramatic, erotically charged movie, possibly too baroque for the late 1960s, was a box office flop. Emma, Anna, Effie, and Co. The focus of a considerable number of the major social novels of the 19th century is on illegitimate love and broken marriage. In the subtitle of Wolfgang Marx's subtle study of the three most famous adulteresses, Emma Bovary, Anna Karenina, and Effie Briest, he adds the phrase, "and their men." Is it too much to claim that the subtitle could also have been Emma, Anna, Effie, and their horses? Indeed, these celebrity romances, like those of many of their fictional contemporaries, are shot through with haunting horse riding and carriage scenes. It's when riding and driving that the intrigue unfurls. It's when driving and riding that intimate relations unfold. Love finds its way into the hidden space of a closed cab. Fate finds its messenger on horseback. Death finds its pale steed. In itself, this is no sensational discovery. After all, horses and carriages were the transport mode of the time. And if we consider the importance of the automobile in the novel, and especially in the cinema of the 20th century, then we might see the presence of horses and carriages in the narrative work of the 19th century as trivial. Yet, what is less trivial is observing how writers like Flaubert, Tolstoy, and Hardy made use of the horse. They exploited horses deliberately as a symbol and a substitute for something that simultaneously called for discussion and for silence, as a veiled reference to the unspoken element at the heart of their novels. The horse therefore stands between amorous women and their husbands, as a living metaphor of love and death. In this world of corsets and muslin, the horse is the only being that can represent the moment of nudity. Tout nerveusement nue dans sa robe de soie, nervously nude in her dress of silk, as Degas put it in a sonnet to a thoroughbred mare. The horses reveal what the people do not voice. They are the means of expressing the inner emotion of lovers and the guide that leads them around the perilous bends of the novel, the chevaux fatales of the 19th century. The manner in which a person sits on horseback and moves with the animal says everything about his inner sensitivity, his sense of his body, his skills and qualities as a lover or a loved one. Charles Bovary may have completed his intellectual studies as well as any dressage horse, but when it comes to riding and driving, the clumsy fellow cuts a poor figure. When he first visits Le Bertreau, the estate of his future father-in-law, his horse slips on the wet grass, shies, and effects a great leap. His first accidental physical contact with Emma comes when he is looking for something that he has mislaid. Comme il faut, it's his riding crop, and as both bent down to look for it at the same time, his chest brushes against her back. She straightened up, red-faced, and looked at him over her shoulder, handing him his riding crop. Bovary's life's journey through the awkwardness that begins at a Norman prep school leads him eventually to the market at Argueil, where, rapidly falling apart after the death of his wife, he sells his horse, the last resource. The girl on horseback, observed by the farmer Gabriel Oak, protagonist of Thomas Hardy's Far From the Madding Crowd, looks as though she must have grown up with her horse. When she rides under the low-hanging branches of a tree, she drops weightlessly backwards, flat upon the pony's back, her head over its tail, her feet against its shoulders, and her eyes to the sky. The rapidity of her glide into this position was that of a kingfisher, its noiselessness that of a hawk. The performer seemed quite at home anywhere between a horse's head and its tail, and the necessity for this abnormal attitude having ceased with the passage of the plantation, she began to adopt another, springing to her accustomed perpendicular like a bowed sapling, and satisfying herself that nobody was in sight, she seated herself in the manner demanded by the saddle, though hardly expected of the woman, and trotted off in the direction of Tunnel Mill. Bathsheba Everdeen, as the young woman, in fact still a girl, is called, does not only ride like an Amazon, she also speaks like a horseback warrior from Herodotus, when she says to the love-struck farmer, "It wouldn't do, Mr. Oak. I want somebody to tame me. I am too independent, and you would never be able to, I know." Indeed, the rest of the novel turns out to be the long, painful story of the domestication of an unruly woman, who breaks two strong, tough men, until at last she finds her way to Mr. Oak, who is flexible, contrary to what his name would suggest, and is always waiting nearby for her. This scene with the acrobatic Amazon on horseback not only opens his eyes to her, but also opens up an unusual way into the sphere of the narrative. What is bright and fiery in this story, and indeed the novel includes a great fire and a storm scene, and seems to take place in a major key, is reflected in Tess of the Dubervilles too, although this time the drama unfolds in a somber minor key. In the horse-themed opening of the novel, we see the nighttime accident involving the stallion Prince. The pointed shaft of the cart had entered the breast of the unhappy prince like a sword, and Tess, is forced to witness his death in helpless despair. It is from her attempts to make good her debt-ridden misfortune that the entire tragic love story unfolds. Tess, a pure woman, ends up on the scaffold after stabbing Alec, the false Duberville, in the heart with a knife after he has ruined her life, leaving him to bleed to death like the horse on the country road. The equine scene at the start of this novel thus provides not only the trigger for ensuing events, but also the leitmotif foreshadowing the conclusion of the story, the stab in the chest and the unstoppable growing pool of blood. As in Far From the Madding Crowd, in Tess, too, the horse's body represents the man's body, or rather its vital, natural, animalistic aspect, as opposed to its social existence that is so entangled in stories and intrigues. In contrast, the author of Anna Karenina draws a correlation between the body of a coveted woman and that of a mare. Against the advice of the English groom, Vronsky goes in to see the nervous Frou-Frou in her stall just before their big race. "Oh, you beauty, you," said Vronsky, moving up to the mare and trying to soothe her. But the nearer he came, the more excited she grew. The mare's excitement had infected Vronsky. He felt the blood rushing to his heart and that, like the horse, he too wanted to move about and attack. The link is further reinforced when after this visit to see his racehorse, and just before his big race, Vronsky goes to see Anna on the terrace at her house, where she is awaiting the return of her son. Anna confesses that she is pregnant. He leaves her, looking at her with ecstasy, having just caught her rapturous smile of love, both of them having agreed in a whisper to meet again that night, and returns to the stable, where his mare excites him in just as sensual a way as his lover shortly before. Vronsky cast another look at the exquisite lines of his favorite mare, who was quivering all over, and tearing himself with an effort from the sight of her, he went out of the stable. Flaubert, Tolstoy, and Fontaine all emphasize the contrast between the dull, Bovary, cold, Karenin, or strict, Instetten, husbands, and their wives' dashing, charming, and bold lovers, Rodolphe, Leon, Vronsky, and Krampus, through a portrait of these men's skills at riding and driving carriages. Granted, Bovary appears as mediocre on horseback, and Fontaine's Instetten might even be described as a good rider, yet they both belong firmly in the plodding world of the sturdy coach, where Bovary inevitably makes an unfortunate impression. As a piece of rolling architecture, a kind of wooden house or dacha on wheels, the coach represents the established world of marriage and family, which is thoughtlessly overrun and smashed to bits by the cavalry of free love. The arrow has already hit the target when Emma and Effie consent to ride out with their respective seducers, albeit in Effie's case, under the suspicious eye of her husband. Effie is seduced in a carriage. Emma, in her second affair, succumbs in a carriage. And Tess, after a long night ride with Alec, and, in one edition of the novel, after being drugged by him, is raped by him in her sleep. When Anna is seen riding a small, sturdy English cob with cropped mane and short tail, it appears for one brief happy moment as though, having been excluded from the beau monde of St. Petersburg and Moscow, she might at least be granted entry into the circles of the provincial landed gentry. Both Tolstoy, who once calculated that he had spent about 7 years of his life in the saddle, and Hardy, had strong links to the countryside. In their depictions of country life, both writers emphasized a second contrast. They demonstrate the penetration of machinery into the provinces, presented as a kind of pastoral idol for all its bleakness, Hardy, and stifling monotony, Tolstoy. In Tolstoy, it is the classic example of the railways, the machine in the garden, which forces itself into the bucolic realm. With Hardy, in Tess, it is initially the horse-drawn mechanical reaper, and later, the steam threshing machine, whose relentlessly whirling wheels allow no respite and seem to drive Tess far over the edge of physical exhaustion into mental despair. While at first glance, technology seems to play a lesser part in Tolstoy's vision of the apocalypse, in truth, the role it is given is even more sinister. To appreciate the power of this narrative device, we must return to the famous steeplechase scene. Vronsky's rise, with a powerful, agile movement, onto the supple back of his mare, again described as excited and jumpy, is the prelude to an event depicted as an act of perfect lovemaking between man and mare over the 3-mile steeplechase course, accompanied by Vronsky's inner exclamations. "Oh, you beauty," thought Vronsky, until the vivid moment when the rider seems so sure of his success. His excitement, his happiness, and his affection for Frou Frou grew keener and keener. It is shortly after this that the fatal moment comes, when Vronsky makes a jockey's error. The mare falls and is unable to get up again, fluttering on the ground at his feet like a wounded bird. Vronsky's clumsy movement had broken her back. Anna, following the action from the stands, is unable to retain her composure and unconsciously reflects the desperate movements of the mare. She began fluttering like a caged bird, at one point getting up to go, at the next turning to Betsy. Karenin, witness to his wife's despair, comprehends at this moment how things stand between her and the officer. The carriage ride home brings confrontation and Anna's passionate confession. And so fate takes its course. In the stands at the racecourse, Anna meets a social death. She simply does not know it yet. The following months will reveal it to her, slowly and bitterly. It will be several hundred pages before Tolstoy, towards the end of the novel, describes Anna's suicide under the wheels of an oncoming freight car. Her real death replicates the fate of the unfortunate racehorse. Anna, looking in the shadow of the truck at the mixture of sand and coal dust which covered the sleepers, misses the first opportunity. But then, before the next comes, she threw aside the red bag and, drawing her head down between her shoulders, dropped on her hands under the truck, and with a light movement, as though she would rise again at once, sank onto her knees. As she crouches on her knees in an animal pose, the truck's wheel hits her and breaks her back. The author does not say this explicitly, but this is the conclusion we are invited to draw when Vronsky sees his dead mistress. Her mangled body, still warm with recent life, stretched out on a table shamelessly exposed to the gaze of all. Her body is shattered, but her head and face are intact. The head, which had escaped hurt, with its heavy plaits and the curls around the temples, was thrown back, and the lovely face with its half-open red lips had frozen into a strange expression, pitiful on the lips and horrible in the fixed open eyes. The manner in which Vronsky recalls the autopsy in the railway shed makes his fatal fall on the racetrack seem like a prefiguration of Anna's cruel end. The death of the beautiful mare foreshadows that of the beloved woman, the difference being that in the former case, the lethal injury to the spine is caused by a human rider, and in the latter case, by a train. The railway accident at the beginning of the novel, where a guard is hit by a train and killed, has a deep emotional impact on Anna, and has been interpreted as a blueprint for the heroine's demise. "It is a bad omen," she said. Yet this accident, as striking as it is, provides only a sort of abstract model for Anna's eventual suicide. It is not until Vronsky's accident on the racetrack that we see a true omen, complete with blood and pulsing with life. The beautiful mare is the novel's living metaphor. Her death is a glimpse, a preliminary sketch, of the fate that awaits Anna at the end of her journey. "To rule is to ride," noted Carl Schmitt. This concise and apodictic expression conveys the idea that riding is much more than a figurative or symbolic action. Indeed, riding can be described, among other things, as an elementary practice of steering. It is a method of driving and controlling. It entails mastery over the will of another being, somewhat like a precursor to cybernetics, only more direct, a neuronavigation between interrelated natures. Two moving, loosely coupled systems circumnavigating the lengthy route of thought, exchanging information directly via the shortcut of touching nerves and tendons, thermal and metabolic systems. The act of riding means that command data is transferred in the form of physical data in a direct exchange of sensory messages. Riding is the connection of two warm, breathing, pulsating bodies, mediated only by a saddle, a blanket, or mere bare skin. humans enter into similar informational connections when they dance together, wrestle, or embrace. Darwin wrote about feeling the heartbeat of his frightened horse's heart through the saddle. Horse and man. One detects the pulse of the other, senses the nervousness, smells the sweat. Even beyond all its symbolic and metaphorical transformations, riding is an articulation of two living bodies, and as with sex, there comes an irreducible moment of pure physics. Wherever he may have gained this awareness, Gustave Flaubert knew of this physical truth innate to living bodies. The fate of the young woman who marries a pedantic country doctor, and now in turn, with pedantic thoroughness, proceeds through every literary cliché of romantic love, is measured against a scale of body temperatures, a scale that captures all expressions of life and desire and all stages of their slow, cruel death. The author closely tracks the pulse of his characters in a very literal sense. Today, for example, Flaubert wrote to Louise Collet in December 1853, when he was working on Madame Bovary, "As a man and as a woman, as lover and mistress both, I have been out riding in a forest. Both as an author and as a rider, he is able to cross the shadowy line between metaphor and metamorphosis. Before Rodolphe becomes Emma's lover, she has already given herself fully to the rhythm of the ride and allowed herself to be seduced by the sway of the animal. Arriving at the edge of the forest, she has already become one with the horse." Like somnambulists, Flaubert and Tolstoy have unconsciously found the zone where two nervous, flighty animals, a woman in love, and an excited horse, exchange their natures. Through narrative means, they produce an unprecedented, breathtaking fluidity between the two species. They are not alone on this path. Someone is there on the road ahead. When Werther, the forerunner of all great lovers in the world of the European novel, confesses he has seized a knife 100 times to relieve his aching heart, he suddenly pictures the image of the horse and the heat of its body. People tell of a noble breed of horses that instinctively bite open a vein when they are exhausted and feverish in order to breathe more freely. I often feel the same and am tempted to open a vein and so find eternal freedom. Turin, A Winter's Tale. The Triangle of Cruelty. It is more than 10 years since the end of the First World War. Throughout this time, Ernst Junger has not stopped expressing the terror of the war, but also a certain fascination with its power. He follows up in Stahlgewitten, Storm of Steel, with Der Kampf als inneres Erlebnis, Battle as an inner experience, Feuer und Blut, Fire and Blood, and finally, Das Wäldchen, 125. Cops, 125. At this point, 12 years after the armistice, the author changes register. He swaps the literary record for the photographic, switching from the written memory of the war to its picture archive. Junger publishes a collection of photographs with the title Das Antlitz des Weltkrieges, The Face of the World War, a selection of the many thousands of wartime photos taken between 1914 to 1918, including propaganda images, reportage, and photographs from private collections, both official and personal. The author does not entirely efface himself, admittedly. Instead, he doubles his role, adding photomontage to his ability to write graphically. Junger selects pictures, groups them into stories, pens narratives and introductory short essays. The tone of these texts is audible, the cold, objective quality for which the author is famous. Just as typical is the moment of the war that particularly interests him. The moment of the assault, when the seemingly empty battlefield suddenly fills with movement. That dangerous moment, when the paralysis of the trenches gives way to the explosive dynamics of the attack. In the shadow of this particular dynamic is a small group of photos. It is easy to overlook their importance, given their dispersal throughout the entire anthology. These are the images of negative energy, photos of the dead and their remains on the battlefield. Among them is a not inconsiderable number of shots of dead horses. At first glance, they do not seem to fit the author's rakishly detached stance. What could be less dashing and stylish than dead horses? Their bloated bellies and frozen legs sticking out of the mud of the Flanders wasteland. The photographs of destroyed military equipment, especially of heavy weapons, shattered tanks and downed flyers, can be more easily explained. This selection of pictures hints at the future author of Der Arbeiter, 1932, The Worker, which portrays the war as a part of the titanic work of technology. But why the dead horses? Horses are not usually the focus of Junger's attention. Of course, he had to learn to ride in the course of his officer training. Thereafter, he did not have much to do with the animals, as he served in the infantry. When he flirted with another branch of the army, it was with the Air Force. Why, when he composed the picture anthology in around 1930, is he suddenly interested in dead horses? Junger's particular brand of post-heroic heroism, one could argue, has changed its bearer. The new man of mechanized warfare has dismounted from his steed and withdrawn into the steel casing of technological war. This is why Junger shows the dead horses. They are the losers of international modernity. But the dead horses are not particularly suitable as illustrations of the stark dynamics of historical displacement. At least, not those presented by Junger. They are too complex, too aesthetic, too emblematic. Take, for example, the photograph of the horse corpses, described in Junger's caption as "horse cadavers in a narrow pass on the Somme." It could hardly be said in a more sober, tight-lipped way. In a landscape sparingly furnished with scrub, rubble, and telegraph poles, this existentialist stage for the theatre of war, we see two dead animals, a pale grey horse and a dapple grey. The dapple grey on the left is more badly maimed. Grenade shrapnel has torn off its foreleg, lacerated its chest, and blown apart its muzzle, while the coat of the grey on the right has two bullet holes. It is the parallelism of the bodies and heads that lends this gruesome image its macabre beauty. The juxtaposition of the bodies of two dead horses creates a heraldic totality, like the lions and the griffins in the coats of arms of ancient clans. The images of the dead horses always retain something of Junger's aesthetic composition, the stage director in the theatre of war. But in the background, concealed, as it were, in the backdrop and in the wings, and within the stage direction itself, the images of the dead horse carry a different message, one of an emotional nature. Contrary to war author Junger's typical air as a cold flaneur wandering through the arena of mechanized warfare, these images of dead horses convey a faint but unmistakable flow of warmth. How casually they create a narrow, clear pathway to pity. What the text author Junger does not want to say, the picture author Junger is able to show. The silent suffering and death of the creature. It is not through the photos of fallen soldiers, but the sight of dead horses, that Junger craps open a chink in the world's hermetic seal for pity to shine through. In this respect, the experience of the war participant and the viewer of war photos agree on one thing. Pictures of dead soldiers arouse horror, but images of dead horses evoke pity. Even in interviews with German soldiers, prisoners of war in the Second World War, the same unchanged motif comes up repeatedly. One pilot describes how they were attacking columns, with all guns blazing. Everywhere we looked, we saw horses fleeing. His interlocutor is shocked. "Oh God, the horses, how awful." The narrator softens his tone. "I felt sorry for the horses, not the people, but I felt sorry for the horses till the very last day." Sympathy for the warhorse is a widespread motif in literature, with a peculiar twist for the 20th century. The horse in combat has irrevocably shifted to the side of the victims. Unlike in the 19th century, indeed, unlike all eras of the past, the horse was no longer on the side of the historic perpetrators, as part of the mighty machine that rides and rolls roughshod over everything, but itself ended up trampled under the wheels of progress. The literature of the Great War sees the horse almost exclusively as an animal dying, dead, or decaying. Thus we have the old horse perishing in the ditch in Joseph Roth's poem, Der Sterbende Gaul, the dying nag, while the horse-drawn artillery drags on by paying no heed. Thus, we have the horses frozen overnight and trapped in the ice of a Finnish lake, in Curzio Malaparte's novel L'Appel, 1949, The Skin, 1952. Thus, we have the mud-drenched, rotting horse corpses in the repeated narrative of the decline of the French cavalry, in the novels of Claude Simon. It is as if, in the literature of 20th century, the dying or dead horse had superseded the 19th century's whipped horse as an emblem. Indeed, the horse of the 19th century still maintained certain reserves of ferocity and terror, while the horse of the 20th century functions above all as a tolling bell, a death notice. This is not to say that the savagely beaten or tormented horse disappeared from the moral canvas of the 20th century without a trace. Austrian writer Karl Kraus was still pursuing the subject in the 1920s, or perhaps more precisely, the issue was pursuing him, and German poet and playwright Elsa Lasker-Schüler in 1913 described the suffering of horses on the bridleways of Berlin's Kurfürstendamm, where sweating and bleeding animals were flogged half to death by boorish carters without awaking the slightest spark of compassion in the lady's newfangled, heaving bosoms. However, that there were bosoms around the turn of the century in which pity did indeed thrive was proved by a remark recorded by art historian Colin Rowe and made by an old lady of Swedish descent, whose father, the Dean of Uppsala Cathedral, had once intended her to marry a young man of Prussian origin. "But my dear Colin, I could never have married Kurt von Beckenrath. He was so cruel to his horses." At the demise of the era of the horse, Elsa Lasker-Schüler's depiction is another grim triangle of cruelty to horses, chalked on the ethics class blackboard. Brutish, often drunken coachmen, indifferent passers-by, and the silently suffering creature. The pair reflecting the original barbarism, the coachman and the horse, are constantly replicated before the eyes of the spectator or witness, who does nothing to deliver the animal from the torment and put a stop to the perpetrator. Often enough it is the unfeeling passer-by who is the actual target of the accusation of moral failure and lack of empathy, because, after all, the coachman is a coarse, uneducated person, drunk or mad, closer to the beaten animal than to the unmoved, onlooking bourgeoisie. From the 18th century, the description of the triangle of cruelty spread throughout the literature of cities and of travel. In his Tableau de Paris of 1781, Louis-Sébastien Mercier dedicated a solid monument of paper to the idea. In the late 18th century, a European debate took this triangle as its starting point, a discussion that outwardly revolved around the widespread cruelty to animals and how it could be avoided. Besides this, however, and perhaps this is the true essence of the matter, it was about the redefinition of the human, about the emergence of a new type of man. In the shadow of the old heroic man, for whom in the 19th century wreaths were still being plaited and monuments erected, emerged a new type, the man of compassion. Figures of empathy. The 19th century invented not only dynamite, the automobile, and the World's Fair, it also brought moral innovations. The most important was undoubtedly compassion, not in the sense of an admirable virtue in others, but as the basis of humane moral feeling and behavior. Of course, the 19th century did not bring compassion into the world, but it perhaps gave a new fundamental value, to which two of the best writers in the German language testify, one in the mode of praise, Schopenhauer, and the other in the form of criticism, Nietzsche. Like any new way of feeling, this innovation also needed figures around whom it could crystallize, that is, become visible and intelligible. They were personifications of a calamity, which witnesses found so awful, so unbearable, a misery that literally cried out to the heavens. But since no help came from the dead heavens of the 19th century, earthly wheels had to set themselves in motion, turning the cogs of editorial offices, pulpits, and cabinets to transform acute shock or outrage into social and legal protection and regulation. Of the numbers of suffering individuals from which the societies of the 19th century formed their experiences, and which permanently changed their moral systems, four stand out in particular. One is the whipped horse, the tortured animal. The others are the working child, the wounded soldier, and the orphan. Together they wander through the nightmares of a tough century, the humiliated and the flayed, a quartet of secular misfortune. The fallen, bleeding to death on the battlefields of war. The young, their youth sacrificed in the factories of capitalism. The fatherless and motherless child. And the animal, tormented before the cold eyes of men. Four incarnations of miseria hominis, revealing the depths to which the rage of nations, the pillage of capitalism, and the savagery of the human heart can lead. Not until Henri Dunant's account of A Memory of Solferino had there ever been such a relentless yet compassionate description of the suffering on the battlefield. His text, published 3 years after the 1859 battle between the Austrians and the French, contributed to the foundation of the Red Cross, and is cited to this day as a model of humanist literary intervention. His text, though, is a relatively late beacon. Since the Napoleonic Wars, since the debacle in Russia in 1812, there had been a mounting body of writing speaking in a similar spirit. Descriptions that seek to say the unspeakable. Where they fall silent, in a reversal of Gotthold Ephraim Lessing's Lacune, the mute speech of painting instead gives expression to the horror. J.M.W. Turner's painting, The Field of Waterloo, first exhibited in 1818, showed the gruesome reality of the night after the battle. Masses of dead, dying and wounded men, distraught women, and in the darkness the hordes of dogs and rats. Dunant bears witness to the same reality half a century later. But unlike Turner's picture, his account is not met by closed eyes and ears. The sensitivities have changed. When one 24-year-old published his most famous book in the summer of 1845, the phenomena he described were considerably older than himself. But Friedrich Engels grew up with the misery of the workers, and especially of their children. He came from a dynasty of textile industrialists who built schoolhouses alongside their factories. If there is a common thread that pervades the condition of the working class in England, it is capitalist society's theft of the spirit and life of its youngest and most vulnerable members. Depriving children of their elementary education meant robbing them of their future. In Engels's eyes, this is a sinful crime that weighs even more heavily than the physical stunting that the brutal exploitation of the working child entails. In a half century from 1780, the level of social violence against children was continuously on the rise. It was not until around 1830 that there was the first sporadic rumble of resistance. As E.P. Thompson put it in his 1963 study of The Making of the English Working Class, the exploitation of little children on this scale and with this intensity was one of the most shameful events in our history. The social reality of the country's high infant mortality rate is countered with an even higher parent mortality rate in the era's novels and short stories. The literature abounds with orphans, half-orphans, social outcasts, foundlings, stepchildren, characters of shady or secretive, if not incestuous, parentage. As obscure as their provenance is the fate of their parents, whose disappearance is rarely explained, and if so, usually in a few sparse, fragmented lines. Rarer still is the reappearance of one of the parents, as in the case of Huck's violent father, Pap, in The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. Granted, he reappears only as a meddlesome ghost that returns to the other side at daybreak. The ranks of orphans and foundlings begin with Goethe's Mignon, Wilhelm Meister's apprenticeship, and Ottilie, elective affinities, continues through Oliver Twist, Quasimodo, Little Mireille in Gottfried Keller's Green Henry, Hans Christian Andersen's The Little Match Girl, and Dostoevsky's Smerdyakov in The Brothers Karamazov, until we get to the large fairy tale orphanage where Cinderella, Snow White, the Seven Ravens, and the 12 Swans all sit and await deliverance. Perhaps the most sublime orphanage of the era was that constructed by The Sorcerer of Bayreuth, Richard Wagner. He gave the orphans and the outcasts the unforgettable language of music. The fundamental right protected these days by our constitutional courts, of the individual to know the names of his or her parents, was unknown in the 19th century. The period's literature laments the plight of orphans and uses it to play furtively with the motifs of patricide and incestuous liaison, whose fruit